The following Veterans Radio program is dedicated to those who served in I Corps from Kantian up to the DMZ.
Live from the Veterans Radio studios on the Ave Maria Network in Ann Arbor, Michigan, this is Veterans Radio, and now, here's your host for today's program, Gary Lilly.
And good morning, and thank you for listening in on Veterans Radio to all the folks all around the world, all except for you people down in Antarctica. If you're not going to get a hold of us, the heck with you. But we have heard from everybody in every continent, every continent in the world, other than Antarctica, and I don't blame them for not getting a hold of us. They're down there covered with ice and snow. We have interviewed a couple of Seabees that spent the winter down there, and it gets cold. But we would like to finally talk to somebody from Antarctica, so if anybody knows anybody in Antarctica, send them an email and tell them to get a hold of us. Tell them to go to veteransradio.net. And they don't have to be in Antarctica. They can be anywhere in the world. Spread the word, veteransradio.net. We love our listeners. Today we're going to have a great program. We have Marv Rivers here in the studio. Marv was a Marine. He was served in Vietnam up in I Corps during 1968-69. 26th Regiment, 2nd Battalion, 26th Regiment, and 1st Marine Division? 5th
Marine Division.
5th Marine Division, I'm sorry. But he spent a lot of time over there, and as I put in the flyer, he stepped on a landmine. But he spent about 9 months in Vietnam prior to that, so there's a lot of things to talk about. He'll be telling us about the people he served with, the impression that he had of what was going on over there, and it's like everybody else that served in Vietnam, I believe he's extremely proud of his service, as are all of us. And over in the control room, there's Matt Durr, who's running the board and keeping everything going right. And good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Gary.
And we have the old slick pilot, Dale Throneberry.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. As I mentioned, today's program is about the experiences of Marv Throneberry. But, you know, Marv, you had a very special tour, but there's a lot of other people that had that same tour. And I just want to get you to say good morning, and then we've got a couple of other things that we'll talk about for the program. But good morning to you, Marvin. Thank you for being here on Veterans Radio.
Good morning, Gary. I want to thank you and Dale and Matt for having me on today.
Out there in the rest of the world right now, we've got troops that are serving in Iraq, Afghanistan, and let's not forget everybody else. We've got people in Central and South America, Europe, Japan, all around the world. I don't know how many bases. I think we've got 144 bases right now around the world, and that's spread pretty thin. We've got a top-notch military, and so for anybody listening out there who's serving right now, we Vietnam vets and other vets are extremely proud of you. We think you're the best there is in the world, and when we see things like those SEALs going in and getting Osama bin Laden, we know we've got the best military in the world, and I don't care if you're a cook in the military. You're probably the best cook in the military in the world. I just want you to know that we Vietnam vets and we other older vets think that today's military is the very best in the world. And for those of you who are coming home, what we want to say is welcome home.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. We've got a great guest lined up here, Marv Rivers. I've known Marv for a number of years, and it was only in the last couple of weeks I learned that Marv actually stepped on a landmine while he was over in Vietnam. We're going to talk about the corpsmen that treated him. We're going to talk about the doctors that took care of him. We're going to talk about the dust-off pilots and all of the people that are there, you know, for when one of our troops gets hurt. And it's going on today. We've got the best in the world. Let there be no mistake about it. Marv, you're a Marine?
Yes, sir.
Always were a Marine? Always will be a Marine?
Yes, sir.
Is there any such thing as an ex-Marine?
No, sir.
Are you? Is there such a thing as a former Marine?
No, sir.
That's, you're a Marine?
Yes, sir.
All right, I'll try to keep that straight. I was a CB, and I was surrounded by you guys, and I got to tell you something. That was when my admiration for the grunts began. When I watched the Marines going out on patrol and watch them sweep, we were up on a hill so we could look down and see them sweeping the rice paddies going off into the hills, and I thought, where did they get such bravery? And also the corpsmen. I watched the corpsmen getting packed to go out on one time, and I asked him what kind of a weapon he carried. He said, I'm authorized a .45, but I carry extra field dressings instead. And I said, you mean you go out there without a weapon? He said, when I need one, I'm too busy to use it, and don't worry, when I really need one, there's plenty laying around, I can take my pick. And Marv, I'm just in awe of the grunts and the corpsmen.
Corpsman to a grunt is an angel from God. He's the people who saved us. A corpsman saved my life.
I did a program called Docs. And, of course, every corpsman, every medic is a doc. And I had on a medic, and I had on a corpsman. And for you people, if you didn't hear that program, go back into the archives probably a couple of years ago and look for that program, Docs. And it got to the point that these guys were basically talking to each other. They were on the phone from different parts of the country, and they started talking about the techniques of saving a guy out on the battlefield, plugging holes with cigarette filters, tearing them off the cigarettes and plugging them in, using the wrappers from cigarette packages to plug holes in the chest, sucking chest wounds, and using the field dressings to plug those holes. And where you have to, if you've got a collapsed lung, you take a needle and you put it under a certain rib, but not over it, to let the air out, or you'll kill them. And oh my gosh, I was in awe. I was listening, and you're going to be talking about a corpsman that was with your outfit. But you joined the Marines in what year?
It was September the 11th, 1967. I joined and went over to Vietnam. It was on my birthday, May 22nd, 1968. It was my birthday present.
What a birthday gift. How old were you?
I was 20. I just turned 20.
Just turned 20. Where did first day in Vietnam, as you got off the plane, what's the impression?
It was very interesting. We flew into Da Nang Airport, and it was being shelled, and they were yelling at us, you know, grab a sea bag and run to the building. And one guy was dragging a sea bag and walking along, and he said, hurry, hurry. And he says, oh, I'm from Detroit. I'm used to this.
Really?
Yeah. And
that's hilarious.
And my first day in Vietnam was 114 degrees in the shade. And for us northern boys, it was too hot. But they keep you in the rear for about 2 weeks and make you do details and fill sandbags and get used to the heat. Before they set you out.
Getting acclimated to the heat.
Yes.
Yes. I remember that drill very well.
Yep.
We turned a sand dune into sea bags and leveled it off so that we could fit two hooches on top of it.
Yep.
When we were told we were going to be taking off the top of that sand dune, I asked the squad leader, are they bringing a D4, you know, bulldozer over from MCB4, which had already been there? He says, you got your D4 on your hip, you know. get out the folding shovel.
Exactly.
Start filling. At a certain point, did you have any idea where you were going to be going?
No, our orders were that I was going to the 2nd Battalion, 26 Marines, but I didn't know, you know, I knew nothing. You know, I was a babe in the woods. But our rear was at Quain Tree, and once I did my 2 weeks in the rear, then they sent me up to Contien. I was with 106 Regulus Rifles.
You Marines, you got some pretty tough basic training.
Yes, sir.
I remember looking at the Marines around us, and we Seabees were in good shape, and I looked at these guys, they all had big arms, and I thought, wow, you guys did a lot of push-ups.
When I went into basics, I weighed 138 pounds. When I got out, I weighed 152, and I was in the best shape of my life.
Probably even thinner at the waist and bigger on the chest and the arms, right?
Yeah.
And,
yes, sir.
And could probably run a long ways without losing your breath.
And, you know, I was never a runner before I went in, but I got to love it. And we would go on these long runs and every morning, you know, particularly up at the rifle range. And it was up at Camp Pendleton. It was in the mountains. And it was just gorgeous scenery. And we could run for hours. It seemed like hours. And I really enjoyed it. And
all you young people out there, the military isn't going to hurt you if it doesn't hurt you. So teaches you a few things and gets you in condition and gets you ready for life. They'll tell you that.
And the statement they had was, the more you sweat in peace, the less you'll bleed more.
There you go. There you go. And we're talking to Marv Rivers, who is a Vietnam veteran, a Marine, who you may have picked up by now. And we're coming to you, I must say, from WDEO 990 AM, our flagship station in Ann Arbor, Michigan, over the Ave Maria Radio Network, and we're very pleased to have you with us. Marv, when you were with the 105 Regulus Rifles, tell us what that is. 106, right?
Yes.
Tell us what that is.
It's 106 millimeter in diameter, and it stands about 3 feet tall, and it's like a cannon, but it has an open breech in the back. So for about 25 yards behind it, there's a huge plume of flames that go out the back. Basically, the gun doesn't move. On top of it is a 50 caliber spotting rifle. So the spotting rifle has both a tracer and white phosphorus in the nose of it. So it was designed to fight tanks. So you can traverse and elevate, and you would fire the 50, and wherever the 50 went, the 106 would Regulus round would go too. So if you're on target, you see a poof come up, and then you fire off the 106, and it follows the same trajectory.
And when you say that flame back there, the reason why it's regulus is there's equal blast front and back.
That's correct.
And that's why it doesn't move.
That's
so
right.
You do not want to be standing behind. Stop that. I've got my computer on. I don't know where that sound came from all of a sudden. So at any rate, you don't want to be standing behind that.
No, it'll definitely kill you.
Okay. So I assume that you take a quick glance to make sure nobody's back there before you fire?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. No. Well, as the gunner, you're looking through, it's like a right-angle telescope, but the assistant gunner pats you on the head when it's okay to fire.
Okay. I fired the 3.5 rocket launcher in training.
Yes.
Same.
Yep.
Yep. Because you got the same thing there. You do not want to be behind one. Now, they were designed for tanks, anti-tank weapons, but they're awfully good at knocking out bunkers.
Yes, that, and there were several rounds. They had the heat round, which is could penetrate through 11 inches of steel. They had a HEPTA round, which if it hit a tank, it would shake everything on the inside, knock rounds off, and eventually blow up. And it also had what we call the downrange round, and it had like about 2,000 flechettes, so it was like little baby arrows about an inch and a quarter long. and you could adjust the knob on it as to where you want that round to blow up downfield. In other words, if your enemy's 800 yards, you set it for 700 yards, and it would blow up, and all these shots would go out.
And it's quite an awesome weapon.
Yes.
I don't know if they have them anymore, do they?
I don't believe so.
I don't think so. I think they're kind of outlawed, or they decided that it's not fair.
Right. Yeah. I think Geneva Convention didn't like
right.
it. You'll also see a 90-millimeter one mounted on Jeeps. You'll see pictures of that. Those are 90 millimeters. Ours is 106.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. Yeah. Now, when you say heat round, that's high explosive anti-tank.
Yes, sir. Right. Exactly. Yep.
Okay. And the other one was?
It was the HEPT, and that's high explosive, and I forgot what the PT stands for.
Anytime you hear something like that in the military, it means something else, right?
Yes.
It doesn't mean there's a lot of heat.
Right.
Although there is.
Yeah.
Okay, did you spend much time in that unit?
I was only with them for about maybe 8 weeks, 10 weeks, and then there was a... grunt captain, Fox Company, Captain Hartman, who had met when I was at the rear, and he asked me if I would like to carry radio for him. And I said, sure. And so I joined a grunt company, and I carried radio for him for a few months. And Captain Hartman was the kind of captain you would walk through fire for. He didn't demand respect. He just commanded it. Uh-huh. And we all loved him. He rotated back to the United States, and a new captain came in. I didn't get along with Soswell, but the S2 officer was going, at the same time, the S2 officer was going through records and looking for people who had language. I had been to language school at Presidio Monterey, and he asked me if I would like to join the Scouts, and so I did. So the last half of my tour, I was with the Scouts.
Okay, and let's go back to that first company commander. You say he commanded respect. In what way? Why did you respect him so much?
It was his demeanor, his care for his men. We would walk around. When we were on a mission, we would everybody would be digging foxholes, and we'd walk around, and I swear he knew everybody's name. You know, he knew if a guy was married, if he had kids, things like that. It was just it was amazing. His memory was amazing to me in that respect, and how he cared for his guys. He cared for them above most anything else.
And as a tactician or as a leader in combat, what was his characteristic there?
Oh, yeah, excellent, excellent. The next cabinet came in, not so good. so I lost confidence with the second one.
Tell us about that story about what you told me about when you were in a firefight and the one Marine came down with heat stroke. Let's give an example.
The second commander who I lost, I didn't have much respect for. We were walking a tree line and about 500 or 600 yards in another direction was another tree line. In between was a desert. And we received fire, so of course automatically turn and we go across the desert to attack the other tree line. And about halfway there, we're pinned down, the captain, and I'm carrying the company net. The company net means I can talk to all the squads. And I don't remember the squad name, but we'll call it Squad 2, said we have a guy down with heat prostration. And Squad 1 said, well, we broke the tree line over here. We got a pool of water, you know. And I radioed over to Squad 2, go to this coordinate. Squad 1 has a pool of water. Get that guy in water. The captain says, I want to see that man. Bring him over here right now. I think he didn't trust his men, and he felt that that guy was trying to get away with something. And I argued, and I said, sir, I says, this guy's brain could cook. I mean, he could possibly die. We got to get him in water. Notwithstanding that, he would require four guys to stand up, walk across the field of fire, so he could just see this guy. once we secured the other tree line basically killed the enemy, we went over to the pond and surge. And there was four guys holding this guy underwater with just his mouth above breaking it. And a helicopter came in and vacuumed him out. Unfortunately, when we got back on board ship, we were afloat at that point in time. When we got back on board ship, I was the one who was brought up before mast.
For
Probably arguing with him in the middle of the heat of combat, but...
Didn't matter, you saved a guy's life.
Yeah, well, yeah, I thought it was the right decision.
There were officers like that. I have to say that the officers that I served under were so good that about 5 years ago I wrote a letter of thanks to my battalion commander and my company commander. They're the kind of people, as you said, that you'd walk through fire for.
Yep.
Because they backed up their men and they trusted their men. They were awfully demanding, but
that's true too.
I saw something over in Vietnam that we learned in military training, that in an ambush you turn and you charge into it. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, that's exactly what I want to do. So I want to just, guys start shooting at me with automatic weapons and everything. I want to spin around and I want to run at them, you know. And I talked to a grunt friend of mine who was with the 101st Airborne. He says, it does seem counterintuitive, doesn't it? But in the end, he said it was the safest thing to do. That was another part where I really, really... my admiration of grunts began. Tell us about that. You just gave us an example of it.
Well, I read something once about the Taliban over in Afghanistan. I know it's the Taliban, whoever they are, were surprised. And they were dealing with Marines. I'm not bragging about Marines over anybody else. I think everybody's brave. But they happened to be dealing with Marines, and they said that they were surprised that they didn't duck or hide or run. He said as soon as they fired on them, they charged them. And that was unnerving to them because they're used to having the upper hand or thinking they can scare people. And that's the way it was in Vietnam, too. As soon as fire came, the guys just knew what to do. They would charge it. They would envelop from the left or right and take over the position. And it was just uncommon bravery. And that's what I respect most about my brothers.
And that's what we talked about before. When you're on Vietnam, on Veterans Radio as a guest, you're not necessarily talking about yourself because your story is the story of thousands of other young men. And how old were you? You were 20 years old?
I was 20. I was actually a little bit old, huh?
Yes. Well, I was ancient. I turned 25 over in Vietnam, and the squad leader was my age, and everybody else in the squad, nobody was old enough to drink back here. So the loads that you guys carried, I saw some unbelievable loads being carried by the grunts.
We, Purdue estimated we carried about 80 pounds between our pack and what was on our belt. You always had to carry two illumination rounds for the mortar team. You carried a half a case of C rations.
Usually one case of what?
C rations. There's 12 meals in the C ration box.
Oh, C ration. I'm
yeah,
sorry.
C ration. Okay. So, and you would get six, another guy get six. And you would carry that, not counting all your ammo and water. And water is a big deal because it was a lot of fresh water.
Right.
And they gave you the halazone tablets, but after one time trying those, you threw those away because they made the water taste intolerable. And, of course, you carry extra bandages for the corpsmen and stuff like that.
Did you carry belts for the M60?
No, I didn't. In my M16 and a couple of bandoliers, I had usually three bandoliers.
How many canteens would you wear?
I carried two. Some guys carried four. Okay. But I carried two.
When I was there,
I'm kind of a camel. I didn't require a lot of water.
When I was there at Hill 35, everybody was wearing one, and one guy or two guys of each patrol was carrying a 5-gallon jerry can.
Yeah.
And I believe that it was one they hadn't learned yet just how hot it was and how much water would be needed, and so there weren't enough canteens there.
Yep, that could very well be.
And I couldn't believe the guys going out. They might have three rounds for a 3.5 rocket launcher in addition to the other gear and a rifle in one hand and a 5-gallon jerry can in the other hand. And it was astounding to me because 5 gallons of water on its own weighs about 42-43 pounds.
That's correct, yeah.
Plus the can.
Yeah.
And they walked long distances. So what was a typical patrol? Where were you? Where was this that took place?
Well, after about 8 weeks in being country, we went afloat. And in our little fleet, we had two, I think you call them HPLs. They were converted to be helicopter carriers, and we had two LSDs, and those carried the LVTs, the Amtraks. And most of our missions were done by helicopter. And so we would fly in, and they could go up and down the coast, and we would support other groups. So if, say, the 9th Marines needed help, we'd go help them out. If the 3rd Marines needed help, we'd go help them out, and we'd do different missions. Our missions would last anywhere from 2 to 8 weeks, and then in between missions, we'd get back on board ship, get a shower, which is very nice, Navy food, which is excellent, and then we get new armor, and we learn about the next mission. I have a little story about Navy food.
Please do.
We ate sea rations 95% of the time. But every once in a while, you'd get to the rear, and you'd go to a mess tent, and they would have, powdered eggs and powdered milk and, whatever.
Right.
On board ship, everything's fresh. And I remember the first time we ate on board ship, the cook had a spatula, and he pointed it to me, and he said, "How many eggs do you want?" And I said, "I get a choice." And he said, "How do you want them?" I said, "I get a choice." I couldn't believe it. Had fresh milk. The Navy food was excellent. And they treated us very well while we were on board ship.
There is a lot of respect amongst the branches of the service. We'll never say it to each other.
Yeah.
But there is a lot of respect. And I hear Marines said, "You were a CB. Oh, thank God for the CBs." And I'm thinking, what? We didn't do anything. All we did was work a little bit. What about you guys?
Yeah.
And work a little bit. But,
A little note about that. I've learned to respect from a long time. My dad was in the Navy. My oldest brother was in the Army. My next oldest brother was in the Air Force. I joined the Marine Corps. So I saw their dedication, their devotion. And so, I have a lot of respect for everybody.
I just sometimes think about the people I served with, and I feel inadequate compared to... I know I worked hard, but boy, I'd look at some of these guys, and oh my gosh, where do they get the strength in the end? Well, we had strength. But anyway, back to... the trouble with doing these interviews is you keep drifting back, and you get these color photographs in your mind of things that went on back there. You would operate off a certain place in the coast and off of I Corps, which is the northern quarter part of Vietnam. And then when you come back on, the ships would steam off to another part of the coast?
Yep, usually overnight. We'd end up and there'd be another part of the, the shoreline.
Uh-huh.
One time we did it off the LSDs, and we went up the Amtraks, and that was kind of interesting. They told us, hot beach, watch out, got to do everything perfect. They went over it with us again, this is what you do, and. So we get in the Amtraks. And
hot meaning you're expecting fire resistance.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah. And they only are about 18 inches out of the water.
Yeah.
And the water splashing in over the top of us, and I got 80 pounds on me, and I go, "I don't swim." and so we come up on the shore, and they drive up on the shore, and that back end opens up. And then the squads run out, and you get down, you peel your packs, and then we went up the beach, squad by squad, and it was perfect. It was beautiful. And who's on the beach? There's four guys from NBC filming us. Later on, it was a very, very, very good operation. It turned out to be a very good one. But that thing, that thing there, they wanted us looking sharp when we came up on the beach for the news people.
Did they know the cameraman would be there?
No. Well, I think the upper echelon did, but we didn't.
So when you say it got to be a good mission, what define good?
Later on in that mission, at this time I'm a scout, and I had language. Language meant that I could speak a little bit. I was not an interpreter,
sure.
But I could. It was to reinforce the relationships with the local people. And later on that mission, one night there was a Viet Cong and a girl who was pressed into service, and they were throwing grenades at us.
Okay, now, we're going to pick that up after that. We're coming up on the first break, and when we get back, we're going to hear about this girl that was throwing grenades at you.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. First Lieutenant Jack Jacobs, although seriously wounded, made repeated trips across an open rice paddy, evacuating wounded and their weapons. Details after this.
As a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, joining IAVA.org really helps in the transition home. It's a network of OIF and OEF vets like me who've got your back here, just like we did over there. That means when you need help navigating the GI Bill, we've got your back. And when you're dealing with the transition home, we've got your back. Or when you just want someone to share stories with, we've got your back. Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org. We've got your back.
Brought to you by IAVA and the Ad Council.
Jacob served as an assistant battalion advisor in Kien Phong Province, Republic of Vietnam. The battalion was advancing when it came under intense heavy machine gun and mortar fire. Jacobs called for and directed airstrikes on the enemy positions. Due to the intensity of the enemy fire and heavy casualties to the command group, including the company commander, the attack stopped and the friendly troops became disorganized. Wounded by mortar fragments, Jacobs assumed command of the company, ordered a withdrawal from the exposed position, and established a defensive perimeter. Despite heavy bleeding from head wounds that impaired his vision, Jacobs returned under intense fire to evacuate a seriously wounded advisor to safety, where he administered life-saving first aid. He then returned through heavy automatic weapons fire to evacuate the wounded company commander. Jacobs made repeated trips across the fire-swept open rice paddies, evacuating wounded and their weapons. On three separate occasions, Jacobs drove off Viet Cong squads who were searching for Allied wounded and weapons, single-handedly killing three and wounding several others. His actions saved the lives of a U.S. advisor and 13 Allied soldiers. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. I'm Gary Lilly. We're talking to Marv Rivers, who was a Marine over in I Corps in Vietnam. We're going to be getting to the amazing part of his story in a few minutes, but last we left you, you were having grenades tossed at you by a VC and a VC girl.
Yes, sir. One of the soldiers shot the guy, and they captured the girl and brought her in. This is all during the nighttime. And because I had language, I was talking to her, and there was another scout with me. I believe his name was Fox, Corporal Fox. And she willingly gave up information, and I was writing it down as best as I could, thinking, God, I hope I'm getting this right. And what I do is I take that information, turn in my to officer. I don't think she was a willing participant in the Viet Cong thing, and that's what we found a lot. When we go into a village, it'd be the very young and very old. But all the teenagers and 20-somethings were either went to Da Nang or the big cities, or they got pressed into service by the Viet Cong. So she gave up information willingly. She talked about a cave. She talked about some armament. She talked about a school and blackboards and outhouses. And I went, outhouse, like toilets. And I go, Later on, there was a mountain, and there's a curving path that goes up around it. Halfway up, there was a cave. There was 97 pieces of armament, like guns and things like that. And some villagers were hiding in there. They gave up no resistance, and they were just hiding. And then you went around the mountain. On the backside, it was kind of like a canyon, actually. And there was blackboards and a classroom and outhouses and benches. And it was a VC training place where the NVA would come down and train the local VC. And so everything she told me was true. And the effort that the government put into me trying to train these some Vietnamese actually worked out very well.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of people that are... don't really comprehend what goes on in the rest of the world. When you say that they would recruit the teens in the 20s, they had, you know, I can just picture people here saying, well, why didn't they just say no? You
know, well, threat of death to their families.
The death of their family, exactly. Mm-hmm. And not a pleasant death either.
No, and we saw many forms of, when I say, torture, atrocities as we go into villages.
And that was by their recruiters or their tax collectors or whatever.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And the tax collectors come through, you know, they would tax their rice. They would take rice from them to help feed their troops.
And they, unfortunately, the media tends to try to bring out a story where our troops are mean, like the SEALs that caught the guy that planned the Fallujah massacre of the civilians.
Yeah.
And he complained he got a bloody nose and they were going to court-martial those SEALs.
Yes.
And these people, if they'd ever see the real world about what happens, and I fortunately never saw what happened in those villages or to those civilians by the VC or the NVA, but I know the atrocities were absolutely brutal and sadistic. And you saw it.
Yes, sir.
There was one thing I wanted to go back to is the Medal of Honor recipient that we played at the bottom of the hour, Jacobs, going back and forth across fields of fire to rescue wounded. That's kind of typical of what you were talking about earlier. That happens so much. This guy happened to get the Medal of Honor, and it takes two living witnesses to say what somebody did. If everybody that did things like that in Vietnam was awarded the Medal of Honor, and in other wars too, there would be a lot of them floating around, wouldn't there?
There were so many brave people who got nothing, yeah. You know, and they're way braver than me. And I just, you just have the world respect for some of the things that these people did.
There, you as a grunt saw it. I as a CB saw it, just saw you guys going out. I only saw you in action one time, and that was getting an ambush about 150 yards out. And that's when they swung and charged against the people that were ambushing them, and they captured or killed all of the ambushers, and one Marine got a nick on his arm, you know, so... I guess it was the safest thing to do in the long run under many circumstances. But the bravery of our troops, of our young men, is beyond belief. Beyond belief.
Yes, I agree with you. I think the people, the young men and women that we send in nowadays, are the best and brightest we have.
They're amazing. I've talked to a lot of them, and you know, a lot of them can't come on because they're still in the military on active duty, and they can't talk about some of the things. But, boy, there should be a number of Medal of Honors out there, too, for these young troops. In fact, the older vets are complaining and raising a ruckus about there's not enough medals being issued.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily the medal, it's the recognition.
It's the recognition, absolutely. And it's like a politically, they don't want to draw attention to the fact that there really are some fighting going on over there. At one point, you were out there and you ended up stepping on a mine. Tell us that story.
I was within the battalion, there's probably about 10 scouts, and they'll take two of us and put us to each company. And on this one particular mission, there was just me. I was attached to Fox Company, and we had received some fire. We're kind of like a little raised up area where we were doing this mission, and it was from down below the night before. So the next day, we went down and searched it out. and there was a squad, and they formed a big cordon while the squad leader, the engineer, and myself went around and found buoy traps, and they had a little bunker there, and the engineer would blow them up. And we were walking along, and both the squad leader and the engineer walked over this mine, and I stepped on it. A lot of people know the typical mine that's like about 15 inches by about 4 inches high. That's called the 30-pounder.
Uh-huh.
The engineer believes what I stepped on was a 12-pound pressure release. That means when you step on it, you arm it, and when you go off of it, it fires. Because all my wounds were up my back, the backside of my legs and my arms. So it's one of those things that throws you about 15 feet. And my first reaction is I grabbed my M16, and the only thing that was left was the barrel and the receiver. Everything else was blown off of it.
Now, that's an amazing thing, because you're getting ready for action, right?
Yeah. It was my first reaction was to grab the gun because we're being attacked.
Yeah.
And then I immediately, the corpsman is there, and the engineer got peppered in the legs, and the squad leader got one round, went right through his flak jacket into his back. And he was on his hands and knees, and he turned around and said, "Don't go into shock, don't go into shock." And I said, "Okay, I'm okay, I'm okay." You know, and immediately the corpsman was there, and he's patching me up, and I kept trying to turn around and look back. And he pushed me back down, and I turned around and looked back, and he pushed me back down. And I said, "All right, just tell me, is it still there? Because I've seen what happened to other guys." And he said, "Yes, it's still here. Now let me do my work." And so...
What was it you saw when you first lifted up, when you were amazed, but you told me...
Well, the very first thing I did is I pushed up off the ground, and I was total blood all the way up my shirt. I had a green T-shirt, and it was just total blood. And I was surprised that much blood came up so fast. That was about 10 o'clock in the morning. We got medevaced out. I remember apologizing to the other two guys that I injured them. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning. I woke up about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The surgeon was there, and he said, "Well," he's looking at my leg, and he says, "Well, we almost cut this off, but we thought we'd leave it on for a while, see how it's going to go." And I was surprised that it was there also, because there was a split all the way down the bottom of my foot from the steel shank, and the boot drove it up in there. And as a matter of fact, afterwards, the only thing that was left of my boot was a top band around my calf. The boot was gone, and I blew it right off. But maybe that steel shank is what saved it. I don't know.
When I'd like to drop back to that corpsman that was working on you. But tell us a little bit more in detail about what this guy was doing. And
he gave me morphine.
Uh-huh.
Which is a wonderful drug for that kind of thing. You feel everything, but you don't care. And it's surprising. But you can tell when something's going on. It's not like the pain relief kind of things they give you for surgery or anything like that. No, you felt it, but
I
didn't care. Yeah. And he's patching up, and he's doing stuff. I left the field naked. I had nothing because I was bleeding from everywhere. It seemed like, you know, yeah. It was worse. It looked worse than I think what it was. But you could look in and see the bone in my thumb and at the base of my thumb, and I had my both arms and hands and legs and stuff like that. So he was working like crazy to keep me patched.
How old do you think he was?
He was a young guy. He must have been 19, 18, 19.
Isn't that astounding? Yeah. Do you know who he is?
No. I'm afraid not, because I was attached to the company, so I didn't work with him all the time.
Would you ever like to meet him again?
Yes. Yeah. There's one person I need to thank. Yeah. So thank you to you, wherever you are.
And I had a corpsman who was with the Marines that went through some really rough times, and I said, "Doc, you know, there are young men and women all around this country that would like to know who you are so that they could say to you, 'Thank you for saving my daddy's life.'"
Yeah, exactly. And
he told me later, he said that meant a lot to him. And so that's why I was curious as to whether or not you knew the corpsman, that 19-year-old that saved your life.
No, I didn't.
Wouldn't it be wonderful?
Yeah.
You said you were naked. Did they throw you on a poncho, or how did you get back on?
The stretchers.
30 seconds.
Yeah, CH-46 came in, and they put you on a stretcher, and they put you on board. Took the helicopter half hour to get to us and 15 minutes back to Da Nang, so 45 minutes. That's excellent time.
It was excellent time. And once they reached the, once they got back to the hospital, I think 98% of our guys lived. And despite the fact, condition they were in, we're at the bottom of the hour, or not the bottom of the hour, we're at the end of the segment. We'll be right back.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
There's a song that means a lot to a Vietnam vet. Well, no, not to a Vietnam vet only, but to anybody that's been in the military and anybody that's especially been in a war. That's all you talk about is going back home. When we left you, you were still in the field, hadn't been carried off yet. They loaded you in on a stretcher and a CH-46 helicopter. You guys didn't get the Hueys. You got the old stuff.
That's correct. We had the 34s, and we had 46s, which is the twin rotor one, and then we had the big one, the 53s, and that had the seven-bladed prop on the top.
The 53. Now that 53. Was a newer one. That was a big guy. And the Sikorsky's. Is that the 46?
Yeah, the 46 is what we call the Sea Knight, and the 53 is the Sea Stallion. And I forgot what we called the 34. It had a name too. Seahorse, probably.
Although they were gasoline powered, they weren't weren't slick like the Hueys. They looked like a big box at the end of a with a tail on it. And did they have gunners on both sides or just one
just,
side?
No, 34 is just on one side.
That's what I thought. Yep.
We only had a door on one side.
Right. Yep. Right. And I thought you had to be kind because there's nothing to stop a bullet. So
right.
As Dale will tell you, and that was pretty thin metal there, and I often wanted no defense on that one side. Kind of had to feel naked for the pilots and for everybody.
Right.
So at any rate, they loaded you in that chopper, and you were conscious the whole time?
Yes.
Was there a corpsman with you the whole time?
Yes, corpsman on board. Came with the helicopter,
right?
And checking on us, and we got into Da Nang, and they had these sawhorses set up.
Okay, so when you say we, the other two guys were evacuated also.
Oh yeah, all at the same time.
Okay.
And they would take the stretchers and put them over the two sawhorses, and that was the what do you call it, triage?
Triage.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And they'd look us over, and actually the chaplain who had been out in the field with us was there, and I recognized him, and I said, "Oh, Chaplain so and so." You know, I don't remember his name now, but you know. And then they went over, and so a young Corman was, you could tell he was nervous, but he had a needle, it was like about a foot long, and he was trying to give me a block on my right shoulder for my right arm. And I looked at him and I said, you're not doing something right. You know, I could just tell. I mean, you could feel it, but I didn't know what. Well, it turned out he punctured my lung on the right side. He went in too deep and punctured my lung. So I was 2 days in Da Nang. I went over to Guam for 3 weeks where they pumped up my lung and they did another operation to debride out the heel bone. From there, I went to Great Lakes Naval Hospital where they had a third operation where they debrided out some more heel bone because you get osteomyelitis in there. When the mine goes off, it forces dirt and stones besides shrapnel up into the bone, and it causes an infection called osteomyelitis.
Marv, you've always been a very upbeat person, always. And I only learned a couple of weeks ago that you had stepped on a mine. That was because you had a recurrence of it and ended up back in the hospital. Tell us about that.
For about a couple months, I've been having some pain in my foot, and I thought it was that plantar fasciitis because I got up my right foot, you know. And but then I started to get this really bad red area on my heel, an infection. I thought it was cellulitis. So I went to urgent care, and the doctor says, yeah, it might be cellulitis. We're going to give you some antibiotic. I want you to come back in a week. And the next day, it got worse. And then I have a kind of like a hole in the back of my heel where the surgery was and where I got injured. And I started to get a lot of discharge out of there. The redness went up my calf, about 3/4 way up to my knee. And so I went in on Friday, and they said, well, you're not going home. So they kept me for about a week, and they were giving me lots of antibiotics. And right now I got a PICC line in my arm, and I do antibiotics at home for 6 weeks. And then they're going to reevaluate me, find out if they need to do more surgery. So I guess what it is the infectious disease team says there was a sleeper cell, so to speak, in my heel that activated. And I says, after 4 decades? And they said, yep, they see it. And so those things can reoccur and come back.
So when somebody serves in the military and serves in a war, and I try to tell people all the time, and it's so hard to express, this isn't 2 years out of your life or 4 years or whatever it was. You know, this is the gift that keeps on giving.
Yes, the war goes on.
The war goes on, and it goes on in the mind, and it goes on in the body.
Yeah.
But you survived leukemia about 6-7 years ago.
2001, I had a bone marrow transplant for myelodysplastic syndrome, which is not covered under Agent Orange as of yet. All the other leukemias are, but aplastic anemia and myelodysplastic syndrome are not. However, there is a congresswoman out in California who's trying to push a bill through to get it as a presumptive disease under Agent Orange. The occurrence in 100,000 people is about 4 out of 100,000 will have it. Amongst Vietnam vets, it's 454, about 100 times more often that Vietnam vets will have it. And then in January, I was diagnosed with ischemic heart disease, which is a cause of Agent Orange also.
Yes. Disability?
I was 70% from Vietnam, and my local representative from the DAV, Jim Dempsey, is putting in a claim for the ischemic heart disease. We'll see what happens.
And you've got, they had to chisel away part of your heel.
I'm missing about a third of my heel bone, yeah.
Which puts extra pressure on your foot?
Yes. Yeah. It's first few years back, it was very painful constantly. Now it's just maybe painful a couple times a week.
And you work on your feet.
Yes.
You're an auto mechanic, a good auto mechanic.
Well, I like being a mechanic, and I chose to do that, and I was not going to surrender to the pain. And so I chose to work on my feet and conquer it.
This sounds self-serving, but I got to tell you something. The people that I have known, the veterans I've known, they're the very best people I've ever known in my life. You get a jerk every now and then, but, you know, by and large, they're the best people that I've ever known. They've got more character, and they overcome. And, you know, you complain because that's your right in the military, but I've never heard you complain. And I did, like I said, I didn't even know you had stepped on a mine. How many people do you know of that have stepped on a mine and didn't lose their foot or whatever?
Not many. I don't think I know of anybody, actually. Okay. So I am the luckiest guy alive, I think, because of that. I went through a form of survivor's guilt after the bone marrow transplant. And so I saw a psychiatrist, and she said, and I said, well, I stepped on a mine, and I'm fine. Oh, why am I so lucky? I went to a bone marrow transplant. I had a perfect match. I'm not taking any medicines. Why am I so lucky? And she said, wow. She says, let's see. You stepped on a mine. You had a bone marrow transplant. There's a lot of people who don't have to do any of that, and you call yourself lucky? And I go, well, I think I am, you know.
It's, That's the one thing about it, is, and that's a big problem, is survivor's guilt. As we talked about before at breakfast, I didn't believe that I had the right to join Vietnam Veterans of America because I was only a CB. And there's so much of that goes on, guys. No matter what happened to them, they always think about somebody that had it worse.
Had it worse.
Rather
exactly.
than whining and crying and all that type of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But, well, Marv, we're down to the last minute. Yeah, free fire zone. What do you want to say in the last 40 seconds?
Well, it's basically what we say all the time, support our troops. We got young men and women over in Iraq and Afghanistan and all over the world, and even at home, at bases at home. We need to support these people. They are our brightest and best, and they are our future.
And they are the best that America has to offer. These people are doing it voluntarily. They didn't get drafted, but then in Vietnam, three-quarters of the people that served there, almost three-quarters, were volunteers. They were not draftees, and that's not the common image that's taught today and hasn't been taught since then. So, Gary Lilly, Veterans Radio, tune in next week for just another important and great guest, the cream of America. And until then, you are dismissed.
Not all views and opinions expressed on this program reflect the views of Veterans Radio or your local station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.